From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. This might surprise some of you, and some of you just aren't going to believe it, but the fact is, if you talk to linguists and experts on this kind of thing, there really isn't anything in the Utah dialect that you cannot find somewhere else. Saying fill instead of feel, or that's so good, or look at all the pretty mountains. They say that same stuff in other places. But here's the interesting part. The linguist David Eddington says people who are from Utah tend to be more critical of this language than people outside the state. So we're tougher on ourselves for the terms we think mark us as Utahns. Today in the program, we're talking about accents and dialects, the Utah ones, but even more broadly, the way we Americans speak, how our language is changing. After the news.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. Our online audio and podcasts are made possible by KUER and its listeners. If you like Radio West, help us make it happen. You can donate $10 right now by texting KUER to 85944. That's KUER to 85944. And thanks.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There's no denying it. Corporate expansion and globalization has changed American culture. Go to a strip mall in most any good-sized American city and you'll find the same restaurants and stores. You can still find the mom-and-pop joints, but it's going to take some effort and some searching. And it would be reasonable to assume the same thing is happening to American dialects or accents, that they're all mushing together because the digital age has made it more and more difficult to be isolated. And it's that regional isolation that seems to keep distinctive accents distinctive. But there's more to it than that. And for some reason, all the powerful forces of homogenization have not neutered the way we speak. Today in the program, we are talking about accents and dialects, Utah ones and the rest of the country, to see if regional accents or terms and words particular to a place are going away in the age of globalization and the internet. Joining us on the program today is David Eddington. He's a linguistics professor at Brigham Young University, where he's studied how Utahns speak. He's joining us today from a studio on the campus of BYU there in Provo. And Professor Eddington, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
I'm glad to be here.
Ben Zimmer is also with us. He's a linguist and a lexicographer. He writes a language column for the Wall Street Journal, which you probably have encountered, and he's the executive producer of Vocabulary.com and the Visual Thesaurus. He's joining us from the studios of NPR there in New York City. And Ben Zimmer, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, I guess I wanted to begin broadly, and we can start drilling down on some particulars as we go. But let's start with Ben Zimmer, you first. What is an accent or a dialect? I've heard it described as something that we use to kind of mark ourselves. But how do you describe it?
Well, yeah, we use terms like accent and dialect rather vaguely, but generally that refers to a style of speaking that is associated with a particular region, and also sometimes there are other demographic factors at play as well. But we usually think of it as a regional pattern that shows common characteristics in, it could be pronunciation patterns, it could be aspects of the lexicon, your word choice, your vocabulary, it could even be grammatical patterns that are used or shared by a particular group of people and can mark them with a kind of regional identity.
David Eddington, how are you describing it? Does that square with what you're thinking about?
Yeah, one thing I want to point out is that the word dialect is kind of emotionally charged. When we say someone speaks a dialect, it means, oh, they speak kind of a bad way. Mm-hmm. So linguists, we tend to talk about varieties. So everyone would say, yeah, I speak a variety of English, but a lot of people wouldn't say, oh, no, I don't speak a dialect.
I think that is something that seems to come up in this conversation a lot. I was going to get to it a little bit later, but this is something, David Eddington, you pointed out, and Ben Zimmer, I want to hear you on this point too. The idea, and I actually mentioned this in the introduction to the program earlier on, that we Utahns, and maybe we're not distinctive in this, but we don't give ourselves a break, David Eddington. We're negative about those kinds of words that we hear that we think are distinctive. And this, the fact that it's emotional, or the fact that we have these negative connotations, I'm wondering what you make of that.
Well, language is social, and so anything that is social related, just like language, can have repercussions, or we can have attitudes about it, say the way people dress or how they paint their house or any sort of social thing, we tend to judge. Language is no different.
Yeah. Ben Zimmer?
Yeah, it's true. I mean, really, we're all speaking these different varieties, but there are only certain aspects of those varieties that really come into our consciousness. A lot of it flies under the radar. The things that do become prominent, so much so that we say, I can identify that person is from that region, very often are stigmatized if they're considered non-standard. And so that kind of stigmatization leads to associating very often bad stereotypes with particular ways of speaking that are seen as different or non-standard. And so, you know, we can see that there's a whole field of something called perceptual dialectology, where you ask people about how you would draw your own dialect map of the country or your own particular region, and what associations you have with people who speak in different ways in different parts of the country. And very often we see that kind of effect. So from the American South, for instance, Southern speech can be heavily stigmatized and associated with all sorts of negative stereotypes about lack of intelligence or laziness and all sorts of things that go along with that in people's stereotypes of the way that people are and relating that to how they speak.
One thing to point out is that what we found as linguists is that there is nothing, say, take a particular sound that people use or a particular grammatical thing, there's nothing linguistically that we can say, oh, that's rural, or that's bad, or that has something that linguistically we can put a finger on. What we tend to find is that what people think about a particular dialectal feature represents more what they think about the people who speak that way.
Mm-hmm. Which I wonder if you're noticing this kind of Mormon, non-Mormon cultural, if it sort of filters through that in Utah, David Eddington.
Well, it does, but it's something, like Ben said, a lot of the features that distinguish one dialect from another are not generally accessible. People don't realize that they exist or don't comment on them. And so there are small differences that my colleagues, Wendy Baker-Smimo and her associates, found between Utahns who were Mormons and Utahns who were not. But they were very slight, subtle things that most people wouldn't catch consciously.
Well, I actually want to get into the particulars about that, because I find that really interesting. But my question more is, do you think that the non-Mormon community or the Mormon community is saying, let's say the non-Mormon community are saying, noticing a particular turn of phrase, for ignorant is one that comes up all of the time, as a way of sort of separating themselves. Like, I heard for ignorant today at a mall. That person is obviously not like me. They're lazy, or they're whatever the sort of judgment is. That it's a way that we use to separate ourselves from the other, from them, whoever the them might be.
Well, linguistic features are always used to denote a group membership. And so that may be true. I would, as far as the for ignorant, for cute, for rude, that expression, I don't know if you could associate that with being a Utah Mormon or a non-Utah Mormon. That'd be something to study.
Well, it seems like you can. It seems like, and this is, I think we keep coming back to this idea, we seem to think certain turns of phrase, certain accents, certain ways of speaking are really unique. When Ben Zimmer, it sounds like that's not really the case. This stuff is all over the place in the country.
That's very often true. I mean, you can, of course, find certain pronunciations or choice of vocabulary, for instance, that could be very specific to a region. That, you know, we still find that to be the case, even though, like we were talking about before, the sort of forces of homogenization at play, we still find these particular aspects that really might set a region off as being distinctive in a particular way. But when linguists are looking at this, very often what they do is they look at a combination of different factors. So there may be very few shibboleths, to use a term from the Bible, that define Utah speakers and are used there and nowhere else. But you can look at combinations of factors, combinations of the way that vowels are pronounced, or other things that relate to the lexicon or to syntax, and you put those all together, and that can form a picture of what it means to speak English in Utah. Mm. Mm.
Another thing to remember is that someone from one state compared to another state, it's not like they're going to have a particular feature and use it 100% of the time in this state, and then you cross the state lines and they use it 0%. It's always a percentage. It's always statistics. It's always, one person does it 20, one person does it 40. And even within the same community, you'll find people of different genders or races or social classes that use or don't use a particular feature to a greater or lesser extent.
It's a matter of gradients, it seems like.
It is.
Yeah. How early do we get an accent? Ben Zimmer, do we know?
That's a good question. Of course, we're dealing with evidence that is in written form. So there's only, certainly before the advent of recording technology. So there's only so much that we can glean from written records about when regional accents start popping up. But we can actually get some information, some interesting things. Even if you just look at the way that words are spelled, sometimes with non-standard spellings, that can be a key to understanding the way that words were pronounced. And so if you look at written records from the New England area going all the way back to the 17th century, you will actually start seeing R's getting dropped in the written form of certain words, which is pretty interesting. That shows that R dropping was going on very early on. In the New England region, it had to do a lot with migration patterns from England, what parts of England people were from and where they were settling. But then that became a real marker of regional identity in Boston and New England more generally. New York developed its own kind of R dropping, and the South, of course, is R-less in its own way as well. Mm. So we can see the early seeds of that kind of regional diversity happening even in the colonial era and in the early days of the Republic.
David Ennington, when Ben Zimmer mentions migration patterns, it seems like Utah has a very interesting rural story. Explain, I'm not sure if I get this right, but it seems like some of the Utah accents that are rendered in the sort of typical rural, American patois are constructions that come from British English, or when the Mormon pioneers who came from the United Kingdom, for example, came to rural enclaves in Utah and settled there, they had a very distinctive way of speaking. What do you know about that story?
Well, one thing about the Western U.S. in general is you had people from all sorts of different dialect areas coming together, and so the West is a little bit less distinct from one region to the next. What's interesting about Utah is that in the early 20th century, basically, the English had stopped coming in mass to most of the U.S. But early 20th century, there's a huge British influx to Utah that the rest of the U.S. didn't get, which brought at least one feature we know of.
Hmm. What's that?
That is what we call propredicate do.
Yeah.
And it's kind of something that's died out except among older speakers in Utah, or maybe rural areas. If I were to ask you, do you ski? You could answer, I used to. Or you could use the more British expression, I used to do.
Yeah.
So putting the do on the end is something that kind of sounds odd to most Americans, but in Great Britain it's just fine, and you'll find it among older Utahns.
Madeline sent us this tweet. She says that her kids went to, she says, the kids I went to high school with in Tooele used to say, used to could, all of the time. Is that a pro-predicate do?
No, that's not. That's double modal, so I might could do it or that sort of thing. It's found all over the U.S. Sometimes it's associated with Utah speech, but you'll find it in the South, in the Midwest. It's all over the U.S.
Ben Zimmer, that pro-predicate do, used to do. Do you see that around the country and other places as well?
No, I mean, if I heard that, my first guess would be it was coming from a British speaker. So it's interesting how these things can pop up in unexpected places like Utah. I mean, very often you can trace back these current, you know, modern day patterns to all the different migration patterns that explain why one population went to another and brought their way of speaking with them. Other times it's more mysterious. I mean, we don't always, as linguists, understand really where a particular shift or change starts from. But once it starts, sometimes it just is like, you know, a snowball effect. It just takes, gathers steam, and next thing you know, it's something that marks a much larger region, even though we can't pinpoint exactly where it came from.
Here's something that we got from Michael on Facebook. He writes, "Nothing is worse than watching one of the fabulous local theater productions and then hearing git or fur or on the television or radio hearing Utah speak or bad grammar. On stage," he writes, "it immediately thrusts me back into reality and also tells me the director didn't do their job. On the radio, bad grammar is just inexcusable." I wonder, there seems to be some now. Let's take grammar out of it. That's a legitimate point. But this question that there is a standard form of English in this country—is there a standard, Ben Zimmer?
Well, we like to talk about a standard, even though most people would not be able to define it very clearly. We generally have a sense of what standard English should be, particularly in written English, of course. And it's much easier to identify a written standard of English. When you're talking about some sort of standard accent of American English, then it gets a lot trickier. If you're talking about the United Kingdom, for instance, they might talk about, historically at least, something called received pronunciation as their kind of standard. And it seems to be a little better defined than the United States with all of its diversity. It's hard to really pinpoint a standard way of speaking. Sometimes if you ask people, well, what sounds standard to you? They might say, well, the way that people talk on the news on television. And so this idea that there's some sort of broadcaster standard of English. But even, you know, if you look at news anchors, for instance, you could encompass everyone from, say, Dan Rather from Texas to Peter Jennings, who was from Canada. He wasn't even American. And yet they sound standard in some ways. So very often it's a kind of a negative definition. We hear things that are not standard and we know, oh, that's wrong, that's bad, very often stigmatized in that way. And so we define the boundaries that way negatively very often.
That's Ben Zimmer. He's a linguist and a language columnist for the Wall Street Journal. David Eddington, also with us, a professor of linguistics at Brigham Young University. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the Utah accent. Well, not just the Utah accent, but though that is part of it. The words we natives use and the way we use them, of course. But we're also surveying the rest of the country to see if regional accents or terms and words particular to a place are going away in the age of globalization and the internet. We have with us David Eddington, a professor of linguistics at Brigham Young University, and Ben Zimmer is also with us, a linguist and a language columnist for the Wall Street Journal. Let's go to the phones. John is with us in Taylorsville, Utah. John, welcome.
Yes, a comment and a little couple of questions. I once heard on public radio, and it was a linguist from back east, and he said that out in the Mountain West, there's a certain dialect called Utonics, and I wonder if they've heard that. Two words or phrases, Henri, is that kind of unique? Or you bet, as in somebody says thank you, and the other person says you bet.
All right, let's go. Let's work our way backward. You bet. Someone says thank you, and you say you bet. I've heard this too, that people have said that's a Utah thing. I don't think that's a Utah thing, though. Is it, David Eddington or Ben Zimmer? Do you know?
Well, it exists here, but I've heard it from as a stereotypical thing from Minnesota also.
You
right,
bet,
you
of course.
Betcha.
Yeah, you bet. You betcha. Fargo, heavens, yes. Ornery. Ornery is the word, of course, but Ornery, I hear that expressed a lot. My folks in the Uinta Basin, David Eddington, is that a Utah thing?
You know, I'm not sure about that. I know that it was commented on by someone I know who came here from Scotland and said, what's Henri?
Right. Ben Zero, are you mystified? Do you hear that?
Well, I mean, it's certainly not in my dialect region, but I could figure it out, I think, from the, you know, ornery becoming ornery. I don't know what the regional distribution is for something like that. It would be interesting. There are great resources available. For instance, the Dictionary of American Regional English is a wonderful resource that it took 50 years to complete, and it's quite comprehensive. It mostly focuses on the lexicon, of course, but it also covers, you know, pronunciation as well. So, you know, DARE, as it's called, might be a good source to check for something like that.
Yeah. David Eddington, one thing that you've pointed out is that, and I'm not sure if this is still the case, but you once said you hadn't found any single thing in Utah that you can't find somewhere else. Is that still true?
Well, I would say the best thing that we found is the use of the word scone to refer to fry bread.
Yeah, yeah.
Rather than a pastry. I think that's the best thing. Another one that I haven't, a couple of people have mentioned slough to slough school, but I have found that some other places around the U.S. The expression for cute, for rude, for cool, that may be a Utahism. I don't know.
Huh.
I haven't found it anyplace else.
I think one of the most interesting things that you've written about or talked about is what you've called the euphemistic expletive. Oh my heck. Or what the fetch. Is that
those
a Utah thing?
Those are very common. Are very common, yes. My understanding is that you actually find that sort of thing among Amish communities as well.
Wow.
Maybe not the exact same things, but the use of euphemistic expletives.
Ben Zimmer, do you know anything about euphemistic expletives elsewhere?
I don't, but I mean, with something like that, of course, you know, you have to take into consideration social factors as well. And if there are religious reasons for being more euphemistic with swearing like that, then that could lead to those sorts of patterns. You know, it's interesting to look at. I'm thinking of one regional pattern that started in Northern California, and that's the use of hella as a kind of intensive adverb. So you can say that's hella good. Or if you want to be more euphemistic, you can say hecka, that's hecka good.
Right.
And so that one isn't tied to, you know, religion or anything like that. But it's interesting, like even these new forms can become euphemized. So hella becomes hecka in that same way.
Here's one word that just came to mind.
Yeah.
Do either of you know what hooky bobbing is?
Hooky bobbing. Wait, is it when you get dragged behind a truck in the winter?
You grab a hold of the bumper and slide.
I've hooky bobbed.
Possibly is a Utahism.
Wow. Ben, are you writing this down?
Yeah, that's unknown here back east, I guess.
Great. We are finding distinctive stuff. Good. Let's go back to the phones. Beverly is with us calling from Manti. Hi, Beverly.
Hi. My husband's from San Pete County, where there was a huge influx of Danish immigrants, and I was told that some of the things that are unique to that area, or that I thought were unique to that area, had to do with the direct translation from Danish. One of those is in under. It's in under the sink. It's in under the bed. And the other one is ending a sentence with. So instead of saying, do you want to go with us, you say, do you want to go with? And the other thing was the pronunciations of A's and O's that were kind of swapped. So a barn is a barn, and to be born is barn. So that they traded those, and I was told it had to do with Danish sentence structure and Danish pronunciation. Just wonder if they have a comment on that.
Hmm. David Eddington, that's probably yours. Go ahead.
Yeah. The in under, I've never heard. That's interesting. As far as, hey, we're going to the store, do you want to go with? You'll find that all over the U.S.
Yeah,
I don't believe that's a Utahism. And the other one was what we call it, the cord card merger.
Right.
So it's people who worship the lard and the ward in Spanish Fark. That used to get a lot of attention. People used to pay a lot of attention to that and say, oh, yeah, you can tell you're from Utah because you say that. The interesting thing about that is if you go to the northeastern U.S., they talk about the Florida Orange Bowl and the Part Authority. So that's nothing strange to Utah. In fact, you can find that in Ireland as well. There's the city of Cork C-O-R-K.
Wow.
If I could chime in on
this. Please, please, yes.
I think what you find with people from the New York area, for instance, talking about oranges from Florida as opposed to oranges from Florida, that that may be occurring actually sort of more on a word-by-word basis, where in a place like Utah or St. Louis, that becomes a full-fledged vowel merger where those vowels come together in all words. So, you know, it might be a little more dissipated, I guess, that bringing together the OR sound and R sound in a place like in the Northeast. As far as come with, go with, I believe if you look at that regionally, you will find not just Danish settlement patterns, but German settlement patterns may have played an important role in propagating that. And so places in Pennsylvania, for instance, or places in the Midwest that saw a lot of German settlement, you may see that go with, come with construction more often.
Going back to the chord card merger,
yeah.
One thing we've noticed is that it's dying.
Yeah,
it's almost you almost only hear from people in their 70s or older. So it's something we've actually documented it. David Bowie has documented it by looking at old recordings from LDS General Conference, and he found that people who were born in the late 19th century started to do it, and then it rose and became very common until about the 1950s, and it's been on the decline since then. I think within 20 years, you won't find it here anymore.
So David Bowie, he was listening to recordings of LDS General Conference and the way these religious leaders were speaking, those who had been born, as you say, in the late 19th century, to get a sort of distinctive sense of all of that. But that's sort of how he did the experiment?
Yeah, so you just had to go count how often did people who were born in Utah different from different age or from different years, how often did they merge and how often didn't they? And it's really interesting. We generally don't have great recordings going back to people born in the 19th century, but in that case, we do.
Hmm. But it's going away. How do you feel about that? That it may be on the decline. That this feature that was so distinctive or so particular is now on the wane.
Well, it's on the wane and others are on the way in.
Yeah.
That's the way language works. Things come and go, just like fashions, just like cars sometimes have fins, sometimes they don't. Sometimes dresses are low, sometimes they're high.
Let's go back to the phones. Scott is with us in Springville, Utah. Scott, hi.
Hi. I wanted to mention something that I noticed on my own and I've never heard anybody else mention, and that's unique to Utah. I've noticed that often a single-syllable word that has a long A sound is converted to a short E, and ones with long E are converted to a short I. For example, someone might say, I hear the store is having a sell, or I don't feel good today. And I've even heard the local news anchors use it just yesterday, I noticed.
Yeah,
is that something
this.
That either of your guests have noticed?
Yeah, David Eddington, this is another one of those mergers where the vowels that precede an L, I guess that's how it works, have this particular trait.
Yeah, we call this the feel-fill merger and the fail-fell merger. Is it common in Utah? Yes. Will you find it in other places in the South, in New Mexico, in Nebraska? It's all over the U.S., but it's fairly common here.
Ben Zimmer, you hear that, you must.
Yeah, absolutely. These mergers may be cropping up in different parts of the country in different ways. But you know, there are things that we can identify as being regional when it comes to vowel mergers. There's a particular merger that's quite common now, for instance, between the vowel in caught, C-O-T, mm-hmm. that you would sleep in, and caught, C-A-U-G-H-T, past tense of catch. Those two vowel sounds coming together, it does happen in parts of the East, but it really took off in the West. And so now pretty much most of west of the Mississippi has that merger, and it's sort of creeping back east again too. And so something like that can spread regionally and then gather enough momentum so that it can become so common that those two words, or another example would be Dawn, D-O-N, versus Dawn, D-A-W-N. In another few decades, that might be unusual to pronounce those words differently, even in the East, where it's still distinct now.
I'm sure most Westerners are saying, what did he say again?
Right.
Well, that's why I spelled it out.
Exactly. Like, what's the difference? Yeah, no, it's true. Let's see. George is with us in Leighton. George, hi.
Hi, Doug. This is a comment about the Midwest accent. We were always told, I'm from there, and we were always told that we didn't have one. But this one summer, I had to babysit an heir to one of our company's distributors in England. And I would take him around, and after the full summer, I was noticing that he spoke so much differently. And one time someone said to him, wow, where is your accent from, Australia? And he says to the girl, I haven't an accent. You have.
Yeah, that you probably get that, right? I mean, that's everyone has an accent but you, I suppose. That must be a common feeling, right? Ben Zimmer or David Eddington?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah,
people tend to think that they don't have an accent. But everyone has an accent as long as they speak. And actually, even sign language speakers have different accents.
Wait, what do you mean?
They have different ways of signing depending on social factors.
Yeah, I guess so. But what is the Utah accent? I mean, forget dialect for just a moment. Is there something that is distinctive, and we can talk about particular ways of speaking, but is there something about our intonation? Is there something about, something particularly distinctive about the way? Let me read an email, as a matter of fact. This comes from Madeline, who writes, my daughter has a degree in applied linguistics, and she's told me that Utah has a lot of call centers because we're known for not having accents. So I think this is interesting because I hear something like a Utah twang here. Is there one? Or David Eddington, what do you think?
Well, there's a little bit different way of speaking, yes. As far as not having an accent, okay, Utahns have a very Western accent generally, maybe sprinkled with a few things, and Midwestern is considered closer to what could be called standard.
Ben Zimmer, are you hearing accents? You're all the way over there from New York?
Well, I mean, there are certain things that are that you can train your ear to hear. So certain things like the vowel merger that we were just talking about, the cot versus caught. Because I have the distinction, I can hear it when other people don't. And it can be confusing to me. I can say, wait, what name did you just say? Is that Don, D-O-N, or D-A-W-N? Mm-hmm. That's a man's name and a woman's name, so you don't want to get them confused. And so I can hear things like that, but because it's different from how I use those sounds. But very often, so much of this is, like I said before, flying under the radar. So we may have regional patterns that we simply aren't aware of, or it's maybe difficult to latch onto. The ones that do rise to prominence are the ones that end up getting stigmatized. And so when we talk about a place like Utah, or some people might say Iowa, or some other place that is thought of as being somehow accentless, which it isn't, very often that just means a lack of these stigmatized patterns, a lack of those sort of things that are evaluated negatively by people who hear them, and that makes it seem like there is no accent, when really there's lots of very interesting regional things going on, even if we're not aware of it.
Yeah. This comes from Melissa, who writes, I've traveled a lot and never found anyone else that calls the glove compartment in a car the jockey box outside of Utah or southern Idaho. Any comment on the word jockey box, David or Ben?
It seems like I've seen that mentioned before in some sort of linguistic survey. And the fact that it was a possible response on the survey means it probably is used outside of Utah and Idaho.
Any idea, Ben?
Sorry, that would be one thing I'd have to check DARE, okay. The Dictionary of American Regional English, to find out where people are using it.
Yeah. Gary writes this, in support of my belief that there is little evidence of a Utah dialect in a negative sense, I would defy anyone to distinguish between Doug and his two guests on the basis of their speech, two Utah residents and one from New York. Gary writes, I get tired of Utah speech being disparaged by people who have no idea what they're talking about. We'll take another quick break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are talking about accents and dialects, Utah ones and the ones around the country. David Eddington is with us. He's a professor of linguistics at Brigham Young University. Ben Zimmer is with us, a linguist and a language columnist for The Wall Street Journal. He's joining us from the studios of NPR there in New York City. Let's go back to the phones. Jim is with us in Farmington, Utah. Jim, welcome.
Hi, Doug. Interesting show. Two things. My folks from Wayne County, and to this day they say, did you go over the R, and do you need a hard cut? The other phrase is okay then, which got made famous in Raising Arizona in the intro, you might remember. Yeah. They kept saying okay then, and my mother said that her entire life.
That's really great. So har and hair, David Eddington, does that sound familiar? Is that something you've looked into?
Something I haven't heard in Utah, but it wouldn't surprise me. It doesn't shock me as being something very particular to Utah.
Okay then.
Never heard that.
Huh. Ben Zimmer, okay then?
You know, I wouldn't be able to pinpoint that to a particular region if I heard it, and certainly the other example of thar for there. Obviously, you know, you could find that in probably British dialects. Yeah, you know, yeah. We think of thar she blows or something like as almost like pirate speak. But then, other examples just from the American West more generally. Things like this might be a bit hard to pinpoint specifically to Utah.
Here's something I hear around here all the time. In fact, my mother, we'll see ya. David Eddington, is that a Utah thing? We'll see ya.
Doesn't sound like anything odd to me.
No, not odd. I mean, well, I
or
mean,
odd, or that you wouldn't find it outside of Utah.
Yeah, I guess that's true. Ben Zimmer, does "we'll see ya" sound that strange or distinctive?
Again, that doesn't sound so regional to me. I don't know. I mean, I haven't spent time in Utah to pick up on which things might sound more distinctively Utahn. But so many of these examples we think about. It's like. As specific to a region, and it may not be, there may be just a sort of an idea that it represents an older way of speaking, a more traditional way of speaking that's associated with rural life and that sort of thing. And that may feel particular to one region, but then you can find that spread out around the country in different pockets.
Yeah. I love it.
Sure. Appreciate you.
Appreciate you. Yeah.
Appreciate you.
Yeah.
How do you spell that?
How do you spell that? Well, that kind of gets, that's a good segue into a couple of comments. One comes from John, who writes, I catch myself saying, gonna have to, or gonna wanna, or I kinda wanna. Oh, no, then he says, I kinda wanna punch myself in the face when I say it. Is that a Utah accent? Brian asks this. He's heard this from time to time. Shwe go out to dinner sometime. Shwe, you know, this idea of sort of mushing these words all together, is that at all distinctive in Utah? Do you hear it from place to place?
In terms of the mushing words together, if you ask people to report on the way that they speak in their particular region of the country, very often they will latch onto something like that. Oh, we mush words together, mm-hmm. As something that they think of as distinct to their region. And say, so when you ask if someone wants to eat, you say "jeet jet," and you say no. Jew, that sort of thing.
Yeah,
which,
yeah.
It's interesting if you just look at the lists of things that people put together for the way you talk in Pittsburgh or the way you talk in some other city or part of the country. These things come up over and over again as a kind of folk linguistics of people picking up on that and thinking about it as regional, even if it isn't necessarily that case. If you actually look at people are reporting this all over the place.
Jeremy sends, I think this was a tweet that he sent. He said, you have to talk about the spoken word, which affects the written word, because I nearly purposely crashed my car, he writes, when I saw a sign that said garage cell, S-E-L-L. I guess that would make sense, right? If you're not a great speller and you just you phonetically work it out? I guess you must see that from time to time, David or Ben?
Yeah, that's one of the cases where you'd actually be able to represent it in writing. Generally, the sorts of things that people talk about are hard to represent in writing. I've actually got a collection of for sale signs.
Do you?
or the real deal.
The real deal, yeah.
Yeah, in written form.
Well, for linguists, that sort of written evidence is wonderful. I mean, I mentioned how linguists look at the historical record to try to find those non-standard spellings, what are called pronunciation spellings, going back hundreds of years. But even now, in the 21st century, linguists are using Twitter, for instance. They're doing sort of text mining on Twitter and finding all sorts of interesting non-standard spellings that sort of map on different regions. The way that you spell something, you might spell it as S-U-T-T-I-N or S-U-M-T-I-N. Mm-hmm. And then you can actually, because people on Twitter very often identify where they're from, you can use that geographic information and plot it on a map. And so even though this is written English, it's written in a form that is similar in some ways to the way that we speak, or we make it similar by using these unusual spellings. And that's a goldmine for linguists who want to study how these things vary from place to place.
Mm. Let's go back to the phone. Pam is with us in Salt Lake. Pam, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Great.
So I actually am a linguist by training, and I'm not from Utah originally. I grew up back east, and so I'm always noticing about how people speak. And one thing I've noticed, and I don't know if it's unique to Utah, but it's a phone thing. People, before they hang up, they say, bye. And I think men and women do it, although I hear women doing it a lot. So I was wondering from your linguist guest whether this is something you've heard in other parts of the country. I find it fascinating and something that I've noticed, I would say, in the past 5 years more than previously.
Well, there are two parts to this that interest me. Let's start with the bye. I hear that too. David Eddington or Ben Zimmer, what do you make of that?
You know, I haven't heard that, but often we look for people's intuitions like that as a way to start a study. So I haven't heard of that before.
Oh, man. My neighbor, LaVie Nelson, God rest her soul, did it all the time. Ben Zimmer, bye. Do you hear that anywhere else?
Not in these parts. I don't know. I would be interested to find out. And again, like David was saying, I mean, sometimes it's something that linguists themselves might not even be aware of until it's pointed out, and then you can actually start getting some real evidence to find out, yeah, this might be something particular to Utah or at least that region.
One thing I've been wondering about myself is if you're standing in line at a store, someone will say, "Can I help? Who's next?" And that strikes me as a little bit unusual.
I don't know.
Can I help whoever's next?
I bet that can I help who's next is probably the most common way to in that service encounter these days in many, many parts of the country. I hear that a lot. Can I help who's next?
Interesting.
David Eddington, this is one of the things I mentioned sort of facetiously, the caller from Leighton. And this is one of the things that you've really explored, the so-called dropped T. I take it that's a term of art, linguistic.
Yeah, and I hate that term because it has nothing to do with the T being dropped. I mean, if we were to drop the T out of mountain, we'd say Mallon.
Yeah.
What it has to do with is two things. First of all, the T is pronounced in a different way. It's a glottal stop. It's Mount. There's kind of a catch in the throat there. Mm-hmm. But that's really not what's going on. Pronouncing mountain with a glottal stop is pretty standard American English all over the U.S. What we're looking at here is what happens after that sound. Mm. Now, more standard speech would be mountain, and the air after that glottal stop is released through the nose. Mountain, Leighton, kitten. What people are commenting on and calling T dropping is actually an oral release where the air comes out your mouth instead of out of your nose. Mount on, kit on, late on.
That's Utah.
That's what people are calling Utah English, but it's funny. A student of mine, Matt Savage, did a study where he looked at this, and when we presented it at a conference, people came up to us and said, well, that's the way they say it in Vermont. Well, I'm from South Carolina, and a lot of people say it. Well, in Southern California, I've heard people say it that way. So it's been stigmatized here, but it exists all over the country. Ben, have you heard that sort of thing?
Yeah, I mean, I'm from New Jersey. The capital of New Jersey is Trenton, but you very often might hear it as Trenton, and Scranton for Scranton, Pennsylvania, Clinton for Clinton, New York. I'm not sure exactly what's happening after that glottal stop is released, if it's through the mouth as you describe it so much, but certainly we hear that kind of glottalization, that the T becoming a glottal stop, and then some sort of release. I don't know how it compares to Utah, but it's something, when I hear it, I think of, you know, again, people saying Trenton for Trenton in New Jersey.
It's a definite oral release. We've actually measured it. What we found that was kind of interesting is that people who do that tend to be younger women. It's not very much of a male thing, and it's definitely not an older person thing. It's really women in their 20s are the ones who tend to do that in Utah.
Well, that gets back to the second part of our caller Pam's question, the question of whether or not this is coming from women more than others. Ben Zimmer, you've said women are often the innovators in this stuff.
That's true. That's been observed time and again, that very often the leading edge of an innovative change for a particular dialect region come from women or young women. Yeah, I mean, it's very interesting to see that. And of course, if we think about the way that young women speak, that's another kind of stigmatization that goes on. We hear a lot in the news about phenomena like vocal fry or creaky voice or uptalk. These vocal patterns that are associated very often with young women, but actually might not be specific to them, but it shows that young women, very often their speech is considered frivolous somehow or not important or not so serious. But really, if you look at the linguistic innovators, very often it's coming from younger women leading the change.
Just a quick one from Justin Davies. He's wondering about the word potato bug. Is that a Utah or Southern Idaho thing, David Eddington? Do you want to put that on your list?
Yeah, actually, that's one of those words that varies quite a bit around the country. I lived in the South for a long time, and it's a roly-poly. Or a pill bug in some places. Potato bug is definitely Utah, probably maybe other places in the West. I've seen it on a map, actually.
What do you mean?
Mapped out how they say different things.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and potato bug is one of them.
That's great.
One thing that I have, another insect name is the little insect that scoots across the top of the water. Lots of different words for that. The word that I grew up saying here in Utah wasn't even on the list of choices. I called it water skeeter.
Yeah, that's what we called it in Davis County, water skeeter.
Yeah, there are great maps for those sorts of things like insect names in the Dictionary of American Regional English, where in the 1960s, they would go out in their word wagons. They would do these surveys, and they'd have these questionnaires where they'd say, what do you call that kind of bug on the water? Mm-hmm. And then write down the answer and then construct maps. A lot of that has changed, of course, in the 50 years since those surveys were done. But we can we can develop new surveys and popular dialect quiz that appeared on the New York Times late last year was based on an online dialect survey that was done about 10 years ago at Harvard. And we still see, those types of, differences in the word choice plotted out by region. And people can actually be quite surprised to find out that what they use is somehow distinctive to their region.
We talked a little bit about this earlier on, the question, and this was something David Eddington pointed out, that, you know, when something goes away, something tends to come in and replace it. There's this ebb and flow. Ben Zimmer, you first. Where do you think our accents are headed? I mean, the basic question I think that we sort of got to was whether or not these regional particulars are being sort of neutered out because of, you know, the digital age and the internet and globalization and those kinds of things. Where do you think it's headed, the accent, the American accent in general?
Well, it's always difficult to predict these things, but you know, you can see some of the pronunciation patterns that we talked about. You know, that those mergers, those vowel mergers, they end up spreading so that, you know, that caught merger, you know, that might be completely merged in a few decades. We also see other things taking off. So the inland north, those are the cities around the Great Lakes, you know, extending all around from Buffalo through, you know, Chicago, Milwaukee. They have their own vowel shift that's been going on, and that is, you know, stronger than ever. Mm. And so we see plenty of indications that despite these forces of homogenization, there are equally strong forces that keep people speaking in particular local or regional ways.
David Eddington?
There's a real good metaphor that John McWhorter uses. He talks about a lava lamp. He said, language is like a lava lamp. It's always there. There's always some bit of wax that's moving, but it never stays still. It's always going to be moving, and it always has been as long as people have been speaking. So it's going to change. It's hard to determine the direction, though.
It's David Eddington, professor of linguistics at Brigham Young University, and Ben Zimmer, a linguist and language columnist for The Wall Street Journal. Gentlemen, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Back in 2008, Utah composer Phil Bimstein and the group Red Rock Rondo recorded music about life around Zion National Park. And Bimstein based one of the songs on a conversation he had with retired school teacher Leon Lewis, who spent his life teaching in Springdale. It's called When the Rooster Crows, and you'll hear a very distinctive accent. We'll hear that as we go out. Radio West, a production of KEWR News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.
Got my first horse in 68. Bought her out in Moccasin. Still got her offspring, old Delta Dawn, down in the field. I've had Appaloosas and Arabians, but I'll never forget old Flame. I taught school most of my life, reading, writing, math, and science. I've always loved poetry. Want to hear my favorite? You may have tangible wealth untold, coffins of silver and coffers of gold, but richer than I you can never be, because I had a mother who read to me.
When the rooster crows,
that means company's coming. Company's coming.
When the rooster crows,
they say company's coming, and I guess it's true, because company's here.
When the rooster crows,
that means company's coming. Company's coming.
When the rooster crows,
they say company's coming. And I guess it's true, because company's here. And I guess it's true, because company's here.